Well, the last time you and I chatted, it was on the occasion of End Country.
That's right.
You remember that?
Yes, I do.
I understand it's being filmed.
Yes, it's coming out this fall. It's already been filmed, and I think it's nearing completion. It will be out this fall, so I hear. It's
Who's in it?
Bruce Willis, and the lead character, the young girl, is played by Emily Lloyd, who's a British actress in a nice little movie called Wish You Were Here.
A British actress?
Yeah.
How's she going to get the Kentucky dialect?
She's very good. Her other movie, she used a dialect too, I think. In English.
Did you coach them on the dialect?
No.
Did you have anything to do with the movie?
No, except at the very beginning, I helped give some direction for the screenplay, so I feel I contributed a little.
Would you want to tackle a screenplay?
I didn't want to do that one, but I'm doing another one based on my short novel, Spence Plus Lila, which came out last year, and I'm trying to write a screenplay now.
Mm-hmm. That was a novel that, was that done by Harper & Row?
Yes.
Because they skipped me on that one, and I missed that, that book, I'm sorry to say. Tell me about that novel.
Well, it's a short novel about a farm couple in their late middle age who are facing a crisis in their family. The mother gets ill and has to go to the hospital. So it brings the family together, and it's a celebration of marriage. Really, it's a love story. And the farm and the rural life is very much a part of the story. And the children of this couple have scattered around and gone through the typical modern experiences, while the farm remains the solid whole that brings these people together. It's funny.
Set in Kentucky?
It's about yes, it is Western Kentucky, and it's about major illness, but it's also funny.
I don't suppose you're ever going to set a story in Pennsylvania.
Oh, I don't see any reason to.
It's so close to you, though.
Well, maybe to. I don't think I really see what's right in front of me. I kind of need a little distance to look back and look around at what's really centrally more important to me, which is the place I come from and the kind of people I feel I know a little better. But really, it's purely personal reasons. It's my family. I see it's familiar in the sense of family. And my attachment to Kentucky and my reason for writing about it probably are just that I am very close to my family.
Well, in reading Love Life, I've noticed that many of the characters, although they have different names and different professions, different jobs, many of them seem almost interchangeable, as though many of them are actually the same people running through the book. Is that an accurate perception?
I don't know. I would like to think that they're individuals. I think that the place gives them a certain connectedness, and different ones are doing different things, but the place and their strong sense of family exert certain kinds of pressures on them that run throughout.
And their socioeconomic
status. Yeah.
Because most of them are blue-collar workers, so they are waitresses and floor walkers and
factory workers.
These stories, they weren't written expressly for a book, were they?
No, they're a collection. Selected from those I've written since my first book of short stories came out,
Shiloh,
in 1982. So this is my work since then.
So this represents about 8 or 9 years worth.
Well, it's really about six or seven.
How does one publish a short story? Obviously, at one point, the short stories were standard in the general magazines. Mm-hmm. There were so few of them. What does an author do to distribute his stories? How does an author get a short story sold in today's market?
Well, it's pretty competitive, and lots of people are writing, and many people are in the writing programs, and it's kind of like basketball, I guess. People thinking they can be successful and get some recognition. Unfortunately, the market is very narrow, and not many magazines publish stories sent with any monetary reward. There are lots of small magazines and lots of stories being published that way.
Well, these stories appeared in what magazines?
Mostly the New Yorker and the Atlantic and Mother Jones, the Paris Review.
Well, then you have a Southern magazine. What kind of magazine is that?
It's a magazine about the South.
They publish only?
They publish fiction. No, they publish, it's a general interest magazine.
Mm-hmm. What does an author do to distribute these stories? And back in the old days, you might have an agent who would sell not only novels, but short stories.
Yeah.
But I was talking to an agent a while ago who says that she just can't afford to try to take on short stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this time of big bucks, I think they're thinking books. You don't need an agent to peddle your short story. All you need is a little patience and some envelopes and stamps, and you send them out, and then you get them back, and then you send them out again. And that's really the best way to go about publishing an individual short story or stories you're writing one at a time. And the stories do get read here and there, not the same way at every publication, but you send them out and see what happens.
So that's your advice to a struggling short story writer?
Oh, sure.
Story
and send it out
unsolicited to a magazine of your choice?
Yeah, yeah. Know the market, though. Know what kind of magazine you're interested in publishing in and what kinds of stuff they take. Not all magazines are interested in the same thing.
Now, tell me about the stories in Love Life and how you approached the writing of these stories. It seems to me that, just parenthetically, that here you have about, I don't know, 15 stories here, and you would have to have a fairly fertile imagination to come up with all of these different ideas. So when you go to your dark study and turn on your word processor and you look at that blank screen, do you have something in mind already, or do you just start?
No, I usually don't know a thing. I just start. And it's like driving blind, and maybe sometimes something will come to me or lead to something else. It's really the best way, though, because that way you're helping to open up the channels to the subconscious and seeing what you've got buried there that will come out and take shape. And you need that sense of freedom away from prescribing what you're going to do or having an outline, just so the characters can walk around and come to life. I never know much about what I'm going to write. Once I get something out, then I can start working on it and shaping it. But it seems a mistake to have a real plan in mind.
Well, of course, one of the stories that caught my eye, obviously, was Airwaves.
Uh-huh.
And how did this story generate?
Oh, gee, I can't remember that one, how it came about, anyway. I think it's probably one of those where I just started writing something like the very beginning where the radio comes on in the morning, loud rock and roll, the kind of snooze alarm or something, and wakes her up. And then I'm wondering about this character and what she's doing with her life, and I kind of meandered around in her life for a while to explore what the issues might be, and before I knew it, she had a brother who had gone off some weird track into kind of fundamentalist preaching in tongues, and then she had a father who just sat around and depended on her, and she couldn't get him to do anything. And then I started to realize, well, there are these men in her life that she's having trouble with. She also had a boyfriend who didn't want her to pay the bills, and he was on unemployment. So it all began to take shape as a set of relationships.
But one line or one character or an incident that you have created leads to another. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. It's very hard to have it all spring full blown in your mind at once. I find that writing is exploring, and testing, and just fooling around with words and seeing what they'll do. I very often just start with, say, an image or a bit of dialogue, and for example, there's a story in there called Bumblebees. And it's about two women who buy a farm together, and they're both kind of they're trying to piece their lives back together because one's been through a shattering divorce and the other one lost her husband and child in an accident. And so they buy this farmhouse and fix it up. And I started that story by through description of an old room in an old farmhouse where bumblebees had gotten in, and there were bumblebees dead all over the floor, and that was an image that was in my mind. And it was actually something I had seen and knew about. So I had all this natural description, but I didn't know who lived in the house or what their story was. But I thought the setting was really interesting, and I don't know how I thought of the relationships, but I made them up too, because the images kind of demanded it.
What you have said is similar to an article I read about 2 weeks ago in the New York Times Sunday Magazine by, a woman's name?
Edna O'Brien?
No. Her name, is up in Michigan. What's her name? And I've interviewed her too. 2 weeks ago, it was about a short story writing, about fiction writing. And anyway, I'll think of her name. I guess I was going to say Katha Pollitt, but it's not Katha Pollitt.
I don't think I read it.
Well, I get her name. She's an excellent writer. I can't remember the title of the last book she wrote, but it was a memoir. And she's also a poet. She's very good. She teaches at the University of Michigan. But anyway, the point that she was making in the story was that as one writes, a terrible truth has come out, I think as she expressed it, that most people don't plan their writing. Mm-hmm. That the writing, they look at a page, and as you expressed, something comes from a word, from a thought, from an image, from a name, from a little incident. Raymond Carver was like that. It would seem to me, at first blush, that would be a very difficult thing to do. That it would be easier if you want to be a writer to sit down with a plan, a complete plan, and finish it. But she destroyed that illusion as I read her article, and it was similar to what you just said.
Well, what we're talking about is the mysteries of the imagination, and I find that the writing process, for me at least, is always a matter of struggling against one's inhibitions and trying to remove those blocks. I mean, writer's block is a real phenomenon, and I find that for me, it's like there's always some kind of block there that I'm working against, and that's what it's all about, kind of getting in there and finding out something that I didn't know was there, or getting at what I know is there but can't remember. Like, I feel like so many of my resources are buried down there, and when you get them out, then they come out in new and surprising combinations, and that's what's fun about it, to get to a frame of mind where this comes out freely and it astonishes you because you've created something out of what seems to be nothing, but what's really just the stuff of your life and stuff you've stored down there. You know, some people have easier access to it than others, I suppose, but it is a mystery, and has always been referred to, I guess, as the muse. When the muse is there, then you're in communication with that.
And you say to yourself, I did that?
Yeah. It's such a surprise to find yourself taking credit for something that you didn't realize you had done. Somebody points out that there's a certain irony or juxtaposition or relationship in the story that you hadn't quite realized was there. And then you say, oh, well, yes, that's true. But it's like you didn't intend it and you didn't even realize it was there. And it's like it took no effort there, and there it is, and you can take credit for it.
Yeah, it's funny. I talked to many, many writers, hundreds and hundreds of them over the past 10 or 15 years, and almost all of them will say something. They'll read a critical review, even a good critical review of their work, and the critic is saying, Miss So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so has developed a penetrating study of evil versus good, and it goes into all the psychological motivations, and the author will inevitably say, I just sat down and wrote a story.
Exactly.
And we're analyzing it. And I just wrote it. I mean, I guess, as you just said, I guess they're right.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
But I didn't mean to explore the dark conflict between good and evil.
Yeah, it just came out that way.
That's right.
I know. That's one of the pleasures, really, of it, to find that happening. And to see that people recognize something in it that you hadn't quite known consciously.
Now, the novelist quite frequently works closely with an editor, but a short story writer, kind of on your own, aren't you?
Yeah, it seems like that, yeah. Short stories don't have as much investment of energy or time as a novel does, certainly. And also, a novel at some point probably does take more of a direction and shape and outline than a short story would, but the creative process itself needs to be open as possible.
Well, the stories that have been accepted at Harper's and the New Yorker and so forth, do you still get editorial input?
Oh, yes. I submit my stories to the New Yorker, and most of them come back with reasons why the story doesn't work. But when a story is accepted, I work very closely with my editor to get it, not to rewrite it or anything, but if they accept it, then it's okay, but then we refine it, and I get very good editorial guidance and very meticulous attention to details.
Well, that leads to another question. So when the story comes back, here is an author, and almost every writer I've spoken to has this feeling, the sense of rejection.
Mm-hmm.
How do you overcome this? Is it a story comes back, do you take it personally? Do you say, oh, my God, I have no career as a writer anymore?
Yeah. Well, it's awfully easy to take something personally, even when you know they didn't mean it personally. But I don't know, I'm pretty resilient about that. And sending stories to the New Yorker, I know they have very high standards, and I think it's important to have that and to be reminded of that and not to think that they'll publish just any old thing you happen to write. I think that would be very bad. And so I respect their decisions and their judgments.
Of course, it's only an opinion. I mean, the story that the New Yorker may not want, Harper's may love.
Yeah, that's true.
So who's right?
Well, you're finally left on your own, yeah.
That's right. It is a matter of opinion in the long run, isn't it? What town in Kentucky did you grow up in?
Mayfield, far western Kentucky, near Paducah, on the Ohio River.
Ohio River, yeah. You make a lot of references in the book to going to places like Cairo.
Yeah, Cairo.
Cairo, Cairo. I'm pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, you are. It's like Cairo, Egypt, but it's pronounced Cairo, Illinois.
I've been across. It's a triangular. See, the Mississippi is there. And
yeah, the Mississippi and the Ohio join together there.
So it creates a triangle.
Sort of, yeah, a little.
Well, I remember a big bridge sweep over the river. I used to go through it when I was a kid. A major highway went along there. And I think my father even stopped for the night there, and we went. I remember seeing it, one of the worst movies I ever saw in my life. I can't remember the name of it. I was a kid, you know, going to this boring movie in Cairo, Illinois. But that's the glamour area. Is that that's even more glamorous than Paducah?
Cairo? Oh, well, I think Cairo is a small town, and I don't know about it now, but when I was growing up, it had a reputation as a rough river town. That's all I know. No, I wouldn't think, I don't know if it's glamorous. It's kind of small. Paducah's a city.
But Mayfield? Mayfield. When you go back, your family still lives in Mayfield. When you go back and you know that everybody in town knows that you've written stories set in Mayfield and the environs, what's it like? Do people recognize themselves, or do they see you as an outsider writing about this area? What?
I think they see me a bit as an outsider, and I don't really know a lot of people that I write about. I tend to invent the characters. And they're like, I assume, they're like what I imagine people to be like in that setting. But I try not to write about individuals. I think my family may come through a lot, but, I don't get much particular response from people. I think a lot of people now are reading the novel in country down there because of the film, and it was filmed on location down there.
That's probably a boon to the economy.
Oh, it was. I don't know how, $3-5 million or something to the local economy. I think people are very happy about it.
Well, then you have to be a local celebrity. That's what Bobby Ann did for us. Next time you go back, they'll put you on a float.
Well, I just received a letter. They invited me to be the Grand Marshal of the Mayfest Parade.
That's great.
I know, it's wonderful.
You're going to do it?
I don't know. I can't quite imagine myself doing it. It's not my style.
Well, most writers admit that literary celebrity is not quite what show business celebrity is. I was talking to Ed Doctorow a while ago, and he said, I could walk down Fifth Avenue, and there will be 10,000 people around me, and 99% of them have never heard of me, and even more than that number have never even read a book of mine. But there is a certain celebrity within literary circles that's very important and very nurturing and very supporting, don't you think?
I guess so. I'm not sure I'm right in the middle of that, but...
You don't go to all the literary teas and cocktails?
No, I don't. Not
did you,
much.
Did you grow up in a literary household?
No, I didn't.
Then what sparked your literary interest?
Well, I was quiet and shy and didn't have any playmates to speak of out in the country. And so I escaped into books, and then that, I think writing was a way of expressing myself. I was too shy to talk, so I always say I write because I don't want to talk.
Well, I think you talk pretty well.
I've learned a little bit about talking.
But it's probably a scary and frightening thing to do what you're doing right now. You don't, what you're doing, you're exposing yourself publicly, verbally. And I would be, if I had to do it, I think I'd be terrified. Especially to television, it would make it even
worse. You mean being interviews?
Interviews. It's important to... get the word out about your book and to talk about your work, but just the act of having to do it, I would find it hard. But you seem to be comfortable.
Well, it's a little different from things that I found so difficult being shy as a kid and in college and so on, and in teaching, which I did for a time. In those situations, you're on the spot, and you, like if you're teaching, you could have a hostile audience automatically, but when people are reading your book and wanting to know about it, it's usually a friendly audience, and so that makes you feel good.
well put, and you don't have to worry about spitballs.
Good.
Love Life, Stories by Bobby M. Mason, very nice book. Thank you very much.
Thank you.